This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, oh, not another zombie movie, The Rise and Fall and Rise of the Living Dead.
So first of all, I want to say I'm really proud of that.
Yeah, we love that title. That title was good. One of our better ones.
I mean, it's awful, but we sort of measure the level of good by how punny the title is. So, yeah, zombies.
A good place to start is probably what we understand by zombies. And there's really sort of the two main ways to go. There's the old folklore type zombie. Mm-hmm. And there is the new, I won't say improved, Hollywood type version, which was first introduced to us really by George Romero with his zombie films.
Yeah.
So the folklore-y type kind of, there's actually been a fair bit of studying. It's to do with things like voodoo and hex, that sort of thing. But they did discover there was an Amazon plant that did destroy part of the brain. And it was almost like a chemical lobotomy of some kind, and it left people sort of needing very, very low quality food and able to carry out basic tasks. There's not a great deal of proof, but there's a lot of studies that's been done about it, which was the idea of the original zombie. They weren't corpses that had clawed out of the grave, as it were.
Yeah. And I mean, there's also, this occurs sort of in nature in different ways. Like, you've got the plant which puts its seeds on ants or something like that, and sort of causes the ant to climb the tree whilst eating its brain, and then the ant dies.
It's a sort of fungal spore, isn't it, that takes over, and then they go on to infect and carry on. And it was sort of the basis of The Last of Us, wasn't it, the video game. And it's actually quite disturbing when you read about it. So
But these things actually do occur in nature. You can understand where the folklore sort of arose from, and where the ideas certainly came from. And, you know, you also consider early zombies from folklore, that vampires fall under the same category. You know, they were the reanimated dead. And I think actually modern zombies are actually a sort of mixture between folklore zombies and folklore vampires, in that they had these lumbering things which could perform basic tasks, and they combined it with a thirst for blood or flesh.
I mean, the thing to remember about the folklore zombies is the fact that they didn't, in general, in most cases, hunger for, you know, human flesh, or any sort of flesh, really.
Yeah.
They had to be commanded to eat. They were basically a slave race.
Yeah, and so it's the combination of these two things, which has kind of put them together. And I thought of something when we decided to do this topic. I had a thought, which is that if you think about it, a very early zombie story technically is Frankenstein.
Yeah, it does fall under it. It's the whole idea of taking death and reversing it.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, even though we wouldn't consider the creature in Frankenstein to be a zombie, it's an excellent example of the reason why the recreation of zombies that we see now are so popular. And I think it's because Frankenstein was obviously a discussion on human capability. And it was during a time where science was advancing at an alarming rate as far as everyone was concerned. And people were worried about where would it end, where would we stop? And it was touching the void of God, you know, playing God. And that's what Frankenstein is about. It's about someone who goes too far. And, you know, it's the whole sort of scientists were so concerned with whether they could do it, they didn't think about whether they should do it, you know.
Yeah, so, and it's summed up beautifully by the line, "I've created a monster." Yeah. As in that is the entire premise of Frankenstein is, what have I done?
Yeah.
And the sad thing about Frankenstein, obviously, is that the creature is very sophisticated in its thought processes.
Yeah, it's
and
a
in what it
monster
wants.
only in appearance. And I mean, we could have an entire episode about Frankenstein. I have a lot of feelings about it. The premise that I'm trying to take away from it is that we look now at modern zombie movies, and almost always there is an implication of it's an experiment gone wrong. It's a disease. It's, there's usually a human cause.
Yeah, almost always it's a case of man, or rather humans, have meddled where they should not have meddled.
And as a consequence of that, in trying to create something better, they've created something totally senseless.
So today we're looking more at the Hollywood version of zombies rather than the folklore zombies.
Yep.
Perhaps looking at folklore zombies, vampires and werewolves might be a good idea at some point in the future. another time. Okay, so looking, there's been an upsurge again. I mean, as we joke as we like about the title, but it is a case of zombies are out of fashion, they're in fashion, they're back in fashion again.
No, I've never really understood. Well, I kind of, and this is going to be interesting because Jules and I differ on this. I am not a zombie fan. I'm actually quite terrified of them. Again, I base this on the very, what I presume to be a reasonable fear of being torn apart and eaten alive. This is not something that I personally would like to spend my day doing. So I find that my fear of zombies is quite justified. I don't really like them. I think I'm more afraid of zombies, actually, than I am of necessarily other things. In the fact, because they are senseless, there is no way you can negotiate with them. They do not see you as a sentient being, possibly because they themselves are not sentient beings. They see you as walking meat, and that's it. And the simplicity of that, I find to be quite terrifying, because they just, there's no mercy, that they don't even register your screams. And you know, I'm not for that. Try and kill you, like most animals, if they're attacking you, they'll go for the throat because they want to kill you quickly so you're not thrashing around. Zombies will just grab the closest part of you, and that's a little bit scary. So I'm not actually a big zombie fan, and to be honest, I'm actually quite sick of seeing them in films. I get quite tired of them. I think that they're quite overdone. But Jules is a bit of an obsession.
I do, and it's not one I'm necessarily comfortable with, because I wrote a blog on this a few years ago, and I might reblog about it because my thoughts and things have progressed since then. But basically, I always had the position of I don't like zombies, as in they either irritated me or they seemed like it was pointless, or it was a case of it was just really gross, and gore horror does nothing for me. It actually bores me.
Yeah.
Anything that is just gore-based is just, it's like, well, it's horrible, but at the same time, it's like, there's a good chance I've seen things that equal that.
The NHS has just totally desensitised you.
That's what the NHS does for you. It also gives you a really black sense of humour. Anyway, I think that the time I had to sort of capitulate and look at things differently, my boyfriend lent me World War Z by Max Brooks. The book. If you've seen the film and haven't read the book, go and read the book, because the only thing the two have in common is the title, and that really is it. There is nothing of the book in the film. But that book is told from the perspective of a journalist who goes around collecting stories of survivors. And it's not like, it's unusual in the sense that you do not follow a character narrative through the entire book. It is seriously this collection of stories of survivors. And some of the situations are utterly horrific. For example, there was one group of survivors who were living down in the catacombs in Paris.
Yeah.
And they had a break-in and they were trapped in the dark. It just reminded me of that part in Watership Down where they're gassing the rabbits and all the holes are being filled in, and the everything's choked with bodies, except that you don't know which bodies are the living dead and which bodies are actual dead. And so there was that horrific part. And then there's another part where they were trying to keep children safe in a nursery, and One woman had never managed to progress beyond the age of 5 mentally, even though she was now sort of in her mid-20s. All she could do was repeat in a child's voice what she'd seen that night. And it's done really, really well in the book, but it is incredibly chilling. And it was a really good book. It was genuine. I don't give out 5-star ratings very often because you basically have to be the love child of Frank Herbert and Stephen King with a bullet to get a 5-star rating out of me. But that was like, okay, that's 5 stars because you have genuinely deprived me of sleep this week. And I think that was the point where I thought, actually, it's not the case that I don't like zombies. I mean, who does like walking, rotting corpses that are trying to tear you apart or trying to infect you, which is even worse? But they're fantastic vehicles for a story. And what's really interesting about any sort of post-apocalyptic or dystopian story, and particularly a zombie story, is the fact that it pushes humanity's back right up against the wall. And that's when you see the absolute best and the absolute worst in the characters.
Yeah.
And I read a lot more zombie fiction since then.
Now, I agree with you on that. I watched The Walking Dead, and I've recently stopped watching it. I kind of got a little bit bored after sort of the later series. But I did really enjoy it to begin with. And I really enjoyed season 2. Now, a lot of people really didn't like it because actually there was very little zombie action in it until the end.
Yeah, for about the first half of that season where they're just looking for the girl that's gone missing.
Yeah, they're looking for the girl who's gone missing and they're at the farm and I really liked it because I found it to be incredibly tense because it was about this group of people surviving and actually the worst threat, they were the worst threat to each other because they had to make these decisions. And, you know, they've got, ultimately, they've got Shane, who would have been a better leader in that he's a bit more psychopathic. He can make the hard decisions that Rick, who is a bit of a, you know, at that point, he's a bit of an idealist, can't make. And subsequently, because Rick can't make these decisions until later on, where he sort of hardens a little bit, people kind of die and bad things happen. And it's about finding the fine line between sort of being heroic and being realistic. And I really liked it because the zombies were this huge tide that were happening, which were the overbearing threat, but actually the biggest threat, because the zombies were kind of, they were just always there. It was just, right, well, at some point we're going to have to deal with that. But they were this overwhelming threat, but the biggest threat was actually the characters themselves being unable to, you know, kind of cope with each other.
Yeah, it's very much, I think that's one of the things that makes zombie fiction, zombie films so scary. If you get beyond the point where the actual zombie apocalypse is happening, where you've got the rising occurring, yeah, and you move on a few months' time and you've got the survivors, the ones who are actually, by Darwin's laws, at least they're either the best that are left or they were the luckiest of those who are left, or they had people with them who could ensure their survival for a short period of time. But the thing that's scary is what you have to do to get to that point, and whether you get infected and have your humanity stripped away from you in that way, or mm-hmm. whether you get to the point which Rick has now really got to in the most recent season of The Walking Dead, where you have had to sacrifice a lot of your humanity on the altar of survival in another way. What they do is it's literally death, walking death, coming for you, and it takes away the things that make you, all the things that you think are important now, like you might enjoy culture and music and reading, all gets boiled down to very much a case of, can you live through the next day or the next 5 minutes? And what are you willing to do that?
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, because the reason actually zombie fiction is so interesting in a way that a lot of, you know, other horror of a similar vein isn't, is because the moment you have a zombie apocalypse, you strip away everything that is to do, that isn't to do with survival. That's literally all. It's all about survival, and that's very engaging for us because we live in a society where we have these rules to kill someone, to commit commit certain crimes just seems so totally, you know, inconceivable for a lot of people. You just couldn't conceive, no, I would never kill somebody, no, I would never do this, that, or the other. Because we have these rules and we have this social construct which allows us to live in a very comfortable way like that. But the moment that social construct is removed, you watch as people have to slowly let go of the rules that allowed them to live in that social construct in order to survive in a different social construct. Yeah. And that's a very interesting, and again, yeah, the people who can't let go of that are the people who die. And it gives rise to a terrifying people instead, you know, the kind of people who didn't thrive in the social, in the previous social construct, who thrive very well in the fight or flight construct instead.
Yeah, we're hampered in a sense by our own nature initially, because we will, when a disease first breaks out and it's not even epidemic, we will try and care for our own people.
Yeah.
And then it becomes apparent it's epidemic, and we will try and care on a much bigger scale in general. And then it becomes something pandemic, and you realise there's no stopping it. And you get a case where something like the Black Death, for example, there was one example of, if we go back to the sort of 1300s, the Black Death in Europe, some people blamed the Jews.
Yeah.
Who obviously get blamed for an awful lot of things throughout history. But the Jews had a habit of washing, which was good. So it made them less likely to have the fleas, which carried the virus, obviously. And they were driven out of Europe to a certain to some extent. And the Polish, or Poland as it was then, took them in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of humanity at its best in a way, because completely alien cultures, and one's just willing to take the outcasts in. In the same period of history, there was a dip back when you had the city-states in Italy, and I want to say it's Florence or Venice, but I'm not sure which one, I can't remember, I'd have to check. And they basically closed the walls to everyone, and when they realised that one of the families was exhibiting signs of the Black Death, they barred everybody in that family into the house and burnt it to the ground. In both cases, those people survived. They weathered out the plague. But you've got an example there of the absolute best and the absolute worst in a way.
Yeah.
And yet you can't really say which one's right and which one's wrong.
Yeah. But the thing is that you could say that the absolute best, there was an element of luck to it as well, because it could have gone an entirely different way.
Yeah, they didn't know.
Yeah. The hard choice, or rather the good choice as we would consider it, you know, the best choice, could ultimately cause, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, you know what I mean? It's and I think zombie fiction in that way, more than any other kind of other apocalyptic fiction, really highlights that element of humanity when we're faced with something that just is unyielding, because zombies are unyielding. I think one of the other scariest things about zombies is that the idea of being followed by a zombie horde that can only walk. I don't believe in running zombies. I've said this recently. Running zombies are not zombies. They're just, what was it?
They're the infected.
It's just necromancers learning, sort of training for the Olympics. You know, I don't believe in running zombies. That's just that I draw the line there. Sort of walking zombies, lumbering zombies. Imagine being followed by sort of a small group of lumbering zombies, right? And they're really slow, and you just outrun them, and you sort of put about three miles of distance between you. You stop for a rest. You wake up, they're there again. You keep running. You put again 3 miles distance. You stop. You rest. They're there following you. A few more have joined them.
Yeah.
And slowly, slowly, you get worn down, and slowly you get tired, but they just keep coming. They don't stop. They're not hindered by the same things that you are. And I think that's just terrifying. That the kind of the slow, you know, you start off feeling quite optimistic about it. Like, look, they're so slow. Look how much distance I've put between myself and them. But they won't stop. You have to stop. You have to stop. You have to eat. you can't just keep running. They are not hindered by the same thing. And that relentlessness is perhaps one of the most terrifying things about zombies.
Yeah. I mean, they are an excellent metaphor for humanity's fear of incurable disease and for death itself, in fact, because let's face it, death stops for nobody in the end.
Yeah, I agree. Now, speaking about incurable diseases, I feel that it's worth us talking about it was a British series called In the Flesh.
Yeah, that's right. It was a BBC Three drama. Mm-hmm. It was considered quite controversial at the time, and it was a little bit different. I mean, the zombie people were coming down with like the Z factor, if you like, and displaying zombie-like. It was presenting as, yeah, zombie symptoms, but they were being cared for and then sent home with their families, and it was caused society to just overboil in this huge melting pot because people were terrified of this disease. They didn't really know what was causing it, how it was passed on. And it was a really strong metaphor for HIV and how people reacted to HIV and, God forbid, what it was called before it was called HIV, which was GRID. And if you don't know, GRID is an acronym for gay-related immunodeficiency syndrome, which is horrible, but that is what they initially called it.
Yeah.
Later, it was rechristened the HIV virus, which is homoimmunodeficiency. And obviously that leads on to AIDS. And it's a very controversial topic, but it was done really, really well. A lot of people didn't like it. It got given a lot of criticism. And I think it's because it's touched a raw nerve. Or, I mean, it's about 4 or 5 years old now, but it touched a raw nerve on come out and think about it openly or not. We like to think that we are humane and that we treat the diseased among us as we would everyone else to a certain extent. And something that would make us make outcasts of people, which is what the HIV virus did for a long time, mm-hmm. was something very uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, especially because obviously a lot of speculative fiction is very often used for metaphors for things. And the most popular metaphors do tend to be metaphors about race, gender and sexuality. And whilst there is a sexuality component that goes along with a metaphor about HIV, especially in the case of In the Flesh, because I believe the main character was gay, is that right? Was coming out.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. It's HIV, actually, I'm going to call it a crisis because, yeah, it suddenly seemed to happen and no one knew where it was and the entire world overlooked it. You know, young people were dying left, right and centre in horrible ways. And they pretend and the government and a lot of police just pretended it wasn't happening until it really started to get very, 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 you know, very serious and started to affect. Really, they started to pay attention when it started to affect heterosexual people.
Yeah.
I don't think it's unfair of me to say that.
No, it's perfectly fair to say that. And it's horrible. And obviously, you have to think about the time that I remember the 80s, and I grew up at a time when they were starting to put out those terrifying adverts about AIDS and obliquely referencing the fact that you needed to use protection and go to the doctor, etc., in these adverts. But it was so oblique that as a child, I didn't know that's what they were saying.
Yeah.
I thought there was some weird virus out there you could catch like a cold.
Which would...
Yeah, and a part of it was also aimed at, say, people who were regular users of heroin or other needle-administered drugs and who were sharing needles as well.
Yeah, and I remember, for me, a particular moment for me, it wasn't actually about needles. I remember watching a film, it was a French film when I was much younger, and in the French film it was two brothers and they were making a blood pact and they both cut themselves and sort of held palms, and my mother turned to me and she said, never ever do that.
Yeah.
And I was there like, obviously there's an implication, don't go around sharing blood with other people, that's probably not a good idea unless you know their blood type and stuff, also just still not a very good idea, don't smear blood onto other people, especially if they've got open wounds themselves. But I knew that I know now, that what it wasn't to do with that. It was because at the time we'd just come out of the huge sort of when these ads were coming out, these terrifying ads, which I saw a few of as well.
Yeah.
And they were very grim.
I mean, I do remember the feeling of controlled hysteria, and you'd hear about it on the news, but where everything was a bit more reserved about, I know it doesn't seem that long ago really, but
yeah.
Back then they weren't talking about things quite as openly. So you got oblique references, and you got words that perhaps you wouldn't necessarily understand at 6 or 7 years old. So you didn't know exactly how this disease was being spread, and nobody would really explain it to you. And I remember being really quite frightened until my mum said, no, you can't just catch it like a cold. And
yeah.
She'd had to say this to me at about 11 o'clock at night, because she'd found me upstairs wide awake. I couldn't sleep because I'd seen one of those horrible AIDS adverts.
But going back to zombies.
Going back to zombies.
Sorry,
yeah.
Going back to zombies. It's very interesting in that case, of course, because we tend to associate zombieism with negative. You know, it tends to have a negative connotation. So it was actually very, very clever to take something that we associate so negatively and use that to basically say, and this is how we looked at people suffering from HIV.
Yeah.
And I think, again, you're right that it touched a nerve, because, you know, we went, no, zombieism is nothing like HIV.
Yeah, nobody wants to remember exactly how people had reacted.
Yeah, and that was a very interesting use of zombies, a very, very interesting use of zombies, which I think made it quite exemplary as a piece of zombie fiction, and stand out from the otherwise fairly blurable mass of other zombie fiction, which is,
yeah.
Oh look, zombies are coming.
It wasn't,
oh, look,
it wasn't horror for,
it
wasn't horror for the sake of it. It wasn't horror for the sake of, oh, a bunch of kids were mucking around in a graveyard, and oh look, the girl who's a little bit wild has got her top off, because that always happens for some reason.
Why do people in horror films insist on getting naked?
Yeah. It's kind of like you're in a graveyard. Okay, I'm not even going to go there because I could rant about that. But I mean,
we could have an entire episode about stupid things people do in horror movies.
Yes, but... yes, we really could.
Yeah.
Now there's a different metaphor coming through from zombies, not necessarily through The Walking Dead, although I do think it's in there, and that's how we as a society are auto-cannibalizing ourselves and our humanity through living the way we do. And that's, I think, brought up really well in Isaac Marion's book Warm Bodies,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the few books I know that's actually been told from the point of view of the zombie. And what it's really saying is that what we need is more compassion and more love and more respect for each other, which sounds incredibly sappy, but if you read the book's really quite gritty. The film's mm-hmm. funny, the book's quite gritty and really gets to the point.
Yeah. And how would you compare the film and the book?
I enjoyed the film. It played it for laughs and it was a little bit cheesy. The book is genuinely has some horrific moments. There's some dark humour in there, and it pulls no punches, basically.
Okay.
It's not gross for the sake of being gross, but let's just say it starts each chapter with a very detailed anatomical drawing taken from Grey's Anatomy, and you go from there.
Okay. Thanks, Grey. Again, I due to fear of being eaten alive, I do tend to avoid zombie fiction. The Walking Dead is one of the only zombie movie series that I've actually watched, because I tend to avoid them otherwise. But speaking of being played for laughs and stuff like that, I do feel we do need to talk about Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Shaun of the Dead, I think, is actually one of my favourites, because so often when you see the zombie movies, I mean, it happens in America. And, you know, occasionally they go, oh, yeah, we tried to get in touch with France, but they're gone as well. And I'm like, yeah, but we don't see that. So as far as we're concerned, America's just a zombie country. You guys can just deal with it on your little continent. The rest of the world is fine. What's happening in America? We don't know. Just leave them to it. But I like Shaun of the Dead because... It was these zombies in this quiet little country town. Which I really, really liked.
And all he wanted was to get to the pub and have a pint.
Yeah, it's all he wanted. And yeah, you have the zombies, which is just in a very sort of realistic kind of way. You know, you have the zombie you see in the body bag. So you just see this body bag sort of flinging itself around. I just really like that. But I was still quite scared, you know, watching The Walking Dead. Not The Walking Dead. Shaun of the Dead. Because in the end, they were still zombies. And in the end, several people did get eaten or turned. And
almost everyone does, don't they?
Yeah, actually, I think it's him and his girlfriend survive. And the girlfriend of Dylan Moran. I don't know what the character's name is, but it's Dylan Moran.
Yeah.
His girlfriend survives, apparently, because she follows him out. She climbs a tree. She has hold of his leg, and she just stays in the tree and eats his leg for about a week before climbing down. So she survives, apparently. It's just a nice detail, which is she grabbed her boyfriend. His leg came off. She beat some zombies off with it, climbed a tree, and survived by gnawing on her boyfriend's leg. Which I think is a perfect sort of mixture between dark humour and very horrific kind of survival instinct. Because, you know, you could turn that completely on its head. It's played as a joke, but you could turn that completely on its head and have this girl having to survive, and the only thing she's got to eat is this part of her loved one, you know.
Yes.
But yeah, I thought it was very good. But then I'm a big fan of the kind of the way that Simon Pegg and Nick Frost kind of do those movies, because they are very dark humor in the end. There's some very good aspects to how they tell the story. But obviously it was playing on a lot of the classics.
Yeah, definitely.
So obviously it was Dawn of the Dead was the main one.
Yeah. Another zombie film I really like is Zombieland. I don't know if you've seen it, but
nope.
the zombie apocalypse happens. You find that most of the really interesting stuff happens after the zombie apocalypse has already really established itself in most zombie fiction. And it's told from the point of view of this teenage lad who's, you know, he's quite sad that his parents are gone, but he's been a bit prepared. He's a bit of a prepper. He knows that, you know what I mean when I say prepper.
Yeah. My brother's a bit of a prepper.
He's expecting the end of the world.
No, isn't he? He has a zombie apocalypse plan. So,
oh right, well, there's nothing wrong with that. I think
it's very sensible to have a plan. I think a country has got a plan. There's a country in the world which has got a zombie apocalypse plan. So there you go.
I suspect quite a lot of them have. Anyway, it's the rules for surviving a zombie apocalypse. He's telling as he goes through, and he meets up with these two girls who. They basically, you know, the first time he meets them, they basically rip him off for supplies and everything by doing the wounded bird routine and then pulling a gun on him. He goes after them to get his stuff back, and then he's successful, and it goes back and forth a bit, and then finally they sort of team up. And it's great. I mean, rule one is, like, if you want to survive the zombie apocalypse, cardio. And it's like, actually, that's a really good point.
It is a very good point.
And it's funny, and it's quite gritty, and it oddly it's a film as it's, you know, it's a vehicle for an adventure story, but it's as much about friendship as anything else. And it's kind of a nice film, even though you've got The Walking Dead everywhere sort of munching on people. It's a really, I know this is a weird thing to say, but it's a really feel good film.
I never would have heard those words together, but all right.
No. Another one I like, and I'm getting to get in trouble for mentioning this with zombies, because there are people who get like very red in the face when you say this, or compare the two kinds, is 28 Days Later. I just think it's a really nicely written... 28 Weeks Later is stupid, very irritating, but 28 Days Later is a very nicely written film, a good script. It's quite sharp, and I like the way it starts. It starts in very much the same way as Walking Dead. I don't know which one came first, but, you know, they're both done really well, so I don't care. And it ends in quite a good way as well. And it goes to some interesting places, you know, these three characters sort of taking this journey right past other people who've gone completely loopy, or who are willing to act as the military and guard things until the end of time because they don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
But it's not really zombies, it's the infected. These are the ones who can, like, swarm and run at you and do seem to have some basic predatory intelligence. Which is not great.
No. But they're not zombies then. Well, no, so here's another one, is the I Am Legend.
Yeah, it's similar.
Again, except... not zombies, they're infected.
Yeah, they're a bit more, they're slightly more vampiric, I think, or certainly from the book.
Yeah, and I think, because I saw a little bit of the film, and interestingly enough, actually, obviously it doesn't stay that way, but usually zombie apocalypse kind of stuff, it's about a group of people trying to survive. Whereas at the beginning of that, for a large portion of that, it's just him, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, he's by himself.
He's by himself,
he's
with his
there
dog.
Trying to get the ant. It's when the dog dies, that just sort of ruined everything for me. Yeah, but, you know, other books that are really good, if anyone's looking for a really good set of zombie books, it's Myra Grant's Feed trilogy, although there is a fourth book coming out in October, and I can't wait. And that's really good, and that's not so much about the zombie apocalypse as it was, because they know what caused it. And this is years and years after The Rising. This is having grown up and becoming a young person in that society, and exactly how safe do you need to be? Do all these measures need to be in place? It's all about the government controlling you via fear. And there's a massive conspiracy theory behind the whole thing. I don't want to spoil it, but it's utterly brilliant. It's really, really clever.
So let's discuss why did the zombie return in popularity? What was it? Is it, as I, you know, previously kind of maybe suggested, it's to do with human kind of fear of rapid progression, and we like to sort of fearmonger ourselves and say, yes, but what if our rapid progression leads us backwards into some terrible archaic time where it was fight or flight, you know, kill or be killed? Is that why zombies have become very popular again?
I think, it is partly that. It's equal parts symptomatic of the times that we live in now, and the subconscious fears that we have. So things like unstoppable disease, or the fact that we're progressing for progress's sake and nobody can see where it's going.
Also the fact that I think we also, you know, at this point in time, we're very rapidly kind of solving a lot of problems that we had before, which felt kind of unsolvable. So we're doing all these amazing feats, and so I think we're actually kind of terrified about the things that we can't solve. That terrifies us.
Yeah, and obviously one of the things we can't solve is the massive population explosion.
Yep, and we also can't solve death yet.
No. No, not
yet. We haven't figured it out.
And that is the other thing, of course. Unless you work in certain jobs, certainly in the UK and in most of the rest of the world, you won't come into contact with an actual corpse. You just don't. It used to be a part of everyday life, certainly in my grandmother's time. If somebody in your family died, they were laid out on the kitchen table or the dining table.
Yes,
so I remember distinctly telling me about this. In state, they were laid out there, and everybody sort of went in, and the mirrors were draped, and one window was left open so the soul could escape, and there were candles lit, and everyone went in to say goodbye. And that was how it was done.
I don't mean to be disrespectful or anything like that, but I really hope they put something else between her and the table, because can you imagine next Sunday where they're like, lunchtime, and you're like, you know, I really don't feel like eating off that table anymore.
My great-grandmother, my grand's mother, was what they called a handy woman, which sounds like someone who goes around with a screwdriver, but it isn't. She, not quite a herbalist or a cunning woman, but she used to go around and help with deliveries of babies and laying out people after they died and things, because people died at home, and it doesn't happen so much now. People tend not to die at home. They tend to go into hospitals or hospices, or, you know, if there's a horrible accident, it might be at the scene.
Yeah.
I'm going to go off on a slight tangent here. Obviously, I worked obviously for the NHS for years, and you will at some point come into contact with a corpse in the NHS, no matter what capacity you work in. I wouldn't say I visited the morgue regularly, I didn't. But there was one job I had where I used to be the only person in at the morning first thing, and I had to do all the unlocking. That was part of my job, being the key holder. Behind the department where I was sort of the manager, there was a non-used corridor, and the only thing it was used for was to take bodies discreetly down to the morgue.
Yeah.
There was a keypad to get you into that particular part of the corridor, but you needed to remember the key to get round to the other side to unlock the other side of the department I worked in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't have the key, you couldn't get out of that corridor. So at 6 o'clock one winter's morning, I let myself into that corridor and all the lights went off because there was a power cut. And I thought, oh, I reached for my keys and then realised that I'd left them on my desk in the other part of the department.
Oh dear.
And then I realised there was a gurney in the corridor. And then I realised that on the gurney, draped in a sheet, which went all the way up over the head.
Oh dear, oh dear.
Was someone who was on their way down to the morgue that obviously the orderlies had to leave there because they'd been called back or beeped, and you know, it was safe enough to leave them there. It wasn't disrespectful or anything.
No.
It was just a case of they were needed elsewhere and the living always take precedence over the dead.
Yes.
So I was there for 40 minutes in the dark with a corpse in the corridor by myself.
Goodness me.
Until someone else came in the building. I actually look back on this and laugh. And even at the time, I was sort of laughing a little bit. But it's even things like that. I wouldn't have said I spent a lot of time around, you know, dead bodies. But it was enough. And even I felt uncomfortable in that situation. I mean, most people probably would do, but...
Yeah. Well, and is it therefore the fact that we're reminded starkly of our own impending death, or is it our love of ghost stories and stuff like that which has implemented a fear about associated with the dead?
I think it's something both more visceral and more complicated. I think it's a case of this, it's not a representation of death. This is, there's something so strange about a dead body. There's nothing in there anymore.
Yeah.
It almost doesn't look real. So there's that. And there's also the sense that, well, yes, I suppose you think, well, one day we're all going to be there, but...
Yeah, difficult to know.
It's an empty shell now. And because it's that very sort of emptiness, that the mystery of what happens between one breath and breath stopping entirely, I think, that is so probably so affecting on so many levels. There's, you know, there's got to be a very special sort of fear trigger for that. And in the zombie sense, there's quite a lot of evidence that some of our ancestors did in fact practice cannibalism. So one tribe might have eaten another because that's how you absorbed strength, theoretically. I mean, the Celts had a similar practice with some things. So there must be a really special fear switch that gets flicked in the human mind if you see something human-shaped eating something human-shaped.
Yeah. Yeah.
This has gone somewhere dark, hasn't it?
Well, no, but I guess, yeah. Is our fear of zombies actually really just linked to our fear of cannibalism?
Yeah.
And I think it's also because, you know, cannibalism can cause all sorts of terrible things in humans, as has been shown by people who've been forced to resort to cannibalism and have gone crazy.
Yes. I mean, there's obviously the Kiru, which is like Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease.
Yeah. And so maybe actually it's, we see, you know, a human eating another human and our brain just goes, oh no, that's not a good thing.
Yeah. It's one of those, it's so imprinted, like people having a fear of snakes or a fear of spiders or, you know, a fear of excrement, actually.
Yeah. Just saying, nope, that's not a thing you should be playing with. Hopefully that's fairly self-evident, but young children would tend to disagree.
But bringing it up a little bit from there.
Sorry.
one of the best books I've read that's actually a zombie fiction, and you never get an explanation as to why it's happened or, you know, how they solve it. It is literally about the survivors. All the best ones to me seem to be about the survivors and how they go on.
Yeah.
Is The Reapers of the Angels by Alden Bell.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the most beautifully written, lyrical, literary piece of zombie fiction I've ever read, and you wouldn't think those words would apply to it.
No, you wouldn't.
It's quite gritty. It doesn't pull any punches. There's gore when there needs to be gore. The main character, Temple, is a sort of 14-15 year old girl who's armed with a Gurkha, But she doesn't hate the zombies. It's a case of, well, they're doing what they're doing and I'm doing what I'm doing kind of thing. And if they're in my way, I'll kill them because I'll kill to survive. But
yeah,
I'm well aware that the survivors like me are much more dangerous. It's a really, really interesting character journey.
Yeah, because it tends to be that the survivors in zombie fiction are more afraid of the zombies than they are of the people around them, even though the people around them are more terrifying, are more dangerous, rather.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you see that them get to that stage in The Walking Dead where it's like, to start with, they're all really totally freaked out because obviously the dead are coming back and trying to eat them, and then get a couple of seasons in and it's kind of like, yeah, stab you in the head and move on, stab you in the head and move on. And the zombies actually aren't the real clear and present danger unless they're in huge numbers.
Yeah.
Did you want to talk about iZombie, which I haven't seen?
Yes, I would like to talk about iZombie, and I think we'll wrap it up after that. Now, iZombie is an American series. I think it's still going on. I haven't actually seen the latest series yet. And again, a very unique look at zombies. They do it in quite a nice little way, which is that zombies aren't nonsensical. As long as they're eating. And they have the very traditional zombies eat brains. It's not actually flesh. They specifically go for the brains. As long as zombies are eating brains, actually, they're pretty much in control of themselves. They are onto themselves. So they're dead, so they don't have a pulse. They don't really have blood that is quite early on in the series. The main character, a young zombie girl, is having open heart surgery, and she's awake and just talking to the guy, and she can't feel pain or anything like that, and they can't really taste anything either. They have to have really, really spicy stuff because it's the only way they can taste stuff. So what happens is, it's about this girl, and she's going to be a surgeon, and she's very clever, and she's all set. She's sort of engaged to this really nice man, and she's encouraged to go to a party. And at a party, there's this drug being passed around, which is kind of causing the craziness, which causes people to turn into zombies. And she gets scratched before jumping overboard. And she turns into a zombie. And so she starts hungering for brains. So she quits her job. She's just about to start this new job as a surgeon. She quits that. She goes and works in a morgue, and she breaks up with her fiance and stuff like that, and that's where it starts. She goes to a morgue so that she can eat the brains of the dead people while still using her medical skills. However, when you eat the brain of somebody, you start to get flashes of what they experienced of their life, basically. Yeah. And you actually start to get characteristics from that person for a short while, until you eat the next brain, or until sort of it dies down. And what happens is that she works in this morgue associated with a police station. And so she ends up helping this policeman, this detective, with his crimes, because she eats the brains of the victims and is able to see flashes of their life and what happened to them. And she tells him that she's psychic. And they go on this amazing journey, and her boss, who works in the morgue, knows that she's a zombie and is trying to help her come up with a cure. And in the meantime, she's this sort of zombie detective. and occasionally, if she sort of, she can go into full zombie mode where she gets really strong and where she gets really sort of, she just freaks out, and then she'll come back to her senses. But yeah, it's a really unique idea in that they can be totally active, normal human beings, so long as they're eating brains. And that's all they need to do. They just need to eat brains.
Yeah.
And then they can continue as per normal. But the problems occur when they don't eat brains, and that's when they go cray cray. It's a very good series, actually.
That sounds really cool. That does actually sound really interesting. I love it when they take things like that in new directions. And if they manage to deliver without making it like super cheesy, then
it's done in a very comic way. It feels like it's a graphic novel. It's yeah. Very nicely put together. And actually, interestingly enough, Walking Dead is what started off as a graphic novel as well, didn't it?
Oh yeah, there's hundreds of them.
But anyway, so I think we should wrap it off. And before we wrap it off, I do want to actually also put out another instance where zombies are starting to get on my nerves, and zombies are appearing left, right, and centre. And it's the latest zombie appearance in a series where zombies really don't belong. This Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Where, and I think it's, again, we're talking about zombies. When I read the books, the way that I sort of saw the White Walkers, yes, they were zombies, but they were zombies in a much more folk traditional kind of sense, if that makes sense.
Yeah, they'd been reanimated to be an army, not
yeah.
To...
Whereas the zombies that we're seeing in the series now are very... look and appear and act and kind of, you know, feel a lot more like modern zombies.
Yeah.
And I'm not a huge fan of that. I'm kind of a bit tired of it.
It's just... there's clearly intelligent leadership there. And, okay, admittedly, like, the series will... It's five big books already, and The Winds of Winter will probably be a massive, massive book in its own right, and I know they've gone past that now.
Yeah.
But it can't possibly have taken even an army of the dead that long to march to the wall.
Really, really long time to march to the wall. Unless they're not heading toward the wall. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they're just larking about.
No, but we know they headed towards the wall and then went away again. What happened? Are they going round from the other side?
Yeah, see, that's the thing though, like, about the whole, they've got this huge wall, and then they say, yeah, wildlings get past the wall, and I'm like, how did the wildlings get past the wall? And you actually look at the map and the wall doesn't actually, there's this huge gap.
It's a bit like the Great Wall of China, where it's like, yeah, it does cover an awful lot of space, but really it's not like it goes all the way around China. In fact, it's in part of China.
Yeah, in fact, like, you look, I'm looking at the map now of Westeros, and the walls, like, covers the whole sort of right side of that little neck bit. And then there's forest and stuff like that, where the wall does not cover, where people can just go around. I'm like, why are the army heading toward the wall? They're just like, right, well, we'll just go round. Because it's like, I guess... normal people wouldn't want to go around because it's got sort of, you know, forest and there might be dangers and stuff like that. But, I mean, you know, if you're an army of the living dead, I don't think you're going to be that concerned about it.
I get that there's supposed to be other fortresses and things along there, and they aren't actually manned anymore because the Brotherhood of the Night's Watch is so undermanned. I mean, it's worse than the NHS, but...
That's what it's a metaphor for.
Yeah, that's totally where George R. R. Martin was going.
So definitely. Well, I always think that maybe if they said, right, you can come and man the wall, and maybe if they said, you're allowed to get married and you're allowed to come and go, they might have more people, you know, doing it instead of, yeah, and once you've joined the Night Watch, you're basically part of a cult for the rest of your existence, and if you try to leave, we'll kill you. I can't really see that sort of working out for a lot of people.
No,
I guess that they also kind of send people on death row up there, don't they?
Yeah.
For real.
So hardened people who can survive. A lot of them.
Yeah, basically. Anyway.
Zombies. Any thoughts, anyone? We're interested.
Do you like them? Do you not like them? Are you tired of seeing them? Or do you want to see more? And what's your favourite zombie movie, book, or adaptation, myth adaptation, to date?
And obviously you can follow us on Podbean or you can follow us on iTunes. We would, you know, be, you know, we'd love to have you following us. Sounds kind of creepy after the whole zombie thing.
Way to get them in, Jules.
Wow, I lost my train of thought halfway through that sentence.
Just start some hypnotic music as well.
Turn you into zombies. On a journey through time and space.
Did the Twilight Zone ever do zombies?
I'm not sure. That was actually a bit before my time.
Oh, good.
Okay, right, thanks then. For listening, guys.
Well, thanks for listening. We'll catch you up next week. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.